better come on in my kitchen. There's hard to be raining out.
Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see, you start out with a little bit of water. You fry some garlic. And you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? And a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet. My country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress. I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry. Stay hungry. Stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the Wine Country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle Anna Jordan. How are you doing this evening? Have you had a nice day? Couldn't really ask for better weather, could you? Well, I guess some people who like it really hot might, but I just thought it was a beautiful, gorgeous day. You could linger as long as you wanted at the farmer's market this weekend. I always think if it's a little bit chilly, you can get warm. Just move around more. Got to go to the Hillsburg Farmer's Market for the first time this season, and it was so nice to be back there. I love the Hillsburg Farmer's Market, seeing old friends like the folks from Bonterra. Lou Preston was there selling, just absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous garlic and really delicious strawberries and a number of other things. Outstanding sauerkraut. Made some new discoveries that I'll be talking about in the next couple of weeks, I hope. And then got to do it all over again in Sebastopol, the Sebastopol Farmers Market today. Sebastopol Berry Farm has been harvesting raspberries for 2 weeks now. They're going to have blueberries next week. So we're just starting to come on to the glorious harvest of summer, and it's just a really nice time of year. Dave Legros, who sells the seafood, and no, it is not all local. The local fishing industry is, it's a really difficult thing here. He's got some really interesting things right now. Starting next week, he will have Ogo, the Hawaiian seaweed that you have to have to make, you'll like this, Lawrence, that you really need to make a very traditional poke. Dave Legros will have Ogo, and he'll start having that at both the Saturday and Sunday farmers markets. He's also going to be able to get Inamona. If you don't want to make your own, he can. You tell him you want it. I think he's going to be able to order it for people. He's also working with a guy who lives in Sausalito who is working with some fishermen down in Louisiana. And we're getting very fresh jumbo prawns from the Gulf about 12 hours after they're out of the water. And yes, we can get into that whole conversation about eating only locally versus supporting farmers and fishermen and such in other areas that really need the support. But for now, if you want really good, fresh, not frozen prawns that do not come from a farm that is destroying the mangroves of the sea, it's a really great place to get them. Anyway, that's sort of what I've been doing all weekend. And now I'm going to introduce our guest, who's been around and visible and then invisible and now visible again. Ernie Shelton opened or took over the little teeny tiny Food for Thought on January 1st, 1991. Welcome to Mouthful, Ernie.
Oh, so nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
And you opened that store with your brother, right?
Yeah, actually, my older brother and I were partners in that store. And
was that his name, Jim?
Jim. Yeah.
Hey, are you
good
impressed?
For you. That's too many years ago. good job.
So
and then my younger brother came to work for us.
Oh, he did. So it was a whole,
as well,
the
shortly
three,
thereafter.
The three brothers.
Yes.
Like my three sons.
Yes.
That old TV show.
Exactly.
From a very long time ago. So you sort of spent that decade, the decade of the 90s, as a really visible grocer, really the main natural foods grocery store in Sonoma County.
I spent that decade running as fast as I could to keep up with the marketplace and the doors that were opening in front of me to basically bring large format natural food markets to the county.
Mm-hmm. And did you feel at the time that you were doing that, did you feel that you were right with the curve, ahead of the curve? What I mean, was it the sort of thing, or yes, this is the time, we've been waiting for this to happen?
Well, I'd worked in the natural foods industry all of my working life, from the time I was 20 years old. And I lived in Santa Barbara for many years and helped open some of the first large format natural food markets in their day in the early 70s. I moved out of state. I lived in Salt Lake City, Utah for 6 years and actually operated a couple natural food markets there. I think I lived in the most liberal neighborhood in the entire state of Utah.
There is one.
Yeah, it's around the University of Utah. And I had a great time there, actually. When I moved back to California, I worked for a natural foods operation in Marin, Living Foods.
Living Foods.
I was the produce director there. And 2 or 3 years into that project, started looking for a business to operate on my own or with my brother. And you know, I was born and raised in Mendocino County, so this is where I wanted to be. Wanted to move a little farther north. Didn't want to be in Marin. Didn't want to do the commute. And so we started looking in Sonoma County, and we were somewhat amazed that there wasn't, there wasn't a larger format natural food market already in the county, and that you know, we felt that it was a ripe plum to pick. Mm-hmm. And so was the timing right? Well, the market proved us to be right.
It seemed like from a consumer's point of view, it was perfect timing.
Yeah, it was amazing. I couldn't have dreamt of a better situation and a better opportunity or a bigger wave to ride at the time.
So we should say that right now, just so we don't want to build suspense, this isn't a mystery. You now have a Sheldon's Market.
Yes, we
in Healdsburg, formerly Anstead's.
Yeah, we put the family team back together.
Is it the three of you?
Yeah, it's the three of us. Although it's primarily my younger brother and I are working in the store. My brother Jim said that he didn't want to buy himself a job, so he's happily pursuing other interests and letting us tend shop for the time being. Mm-hmm. We bought the Anstead store last July. It's a nice, medium-sized store, a little 4,000-square-foot shop. Mm-hmm. I think it's, ideal for the community that it serves up in Healdsburg. Mm-hmm. Good size. It's all very human size and
right on the edge of downtown.
Comfortable to be in. Uh-huh. Yeah, 2 blocks north of the plaza. Uh-huh. Short walk from downtown. Mm-hmm. Close enough to serve all of the downtown community very well.
So I want to, now that people know that that's sort of on one hand why you're here, I want to go back to what happened during the 90s.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think is really important, let's say you sell to Whole Foods. Somebody moves here a week after that Whole Foods opens, and that whole memory of what had gone before in the previous decade, they know nothing about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, so much of what I care about is what was there before.
Mm-hmm.
How did this get to there? So I just think that's important in understanding your community. So I wanted you to talk about how Food for Thought grew up until the sale.
Uh-huh. Well, we bought a little 2,000-square-foot shop in Sebastopol.
It was 2,000 square feet?
Yeah, it was.
What was that place, 150 square
feet? it was a tiny little mite, but, it had been open for a couple of years, been opened by a local couple. We had the opportunity to buy the store with a sense that in that community we could be very, very successful. Mm-hmm. The store was successful as it was being operated. And we felt that we could expand the vision to have it reflect the needs of the community. It was very well defined, but it was defined more by the by the operator's vision of what they wanted the store to be, mm-hmm. and not necessarily a full reflection of what the community's desires were at the time. Mm-hmm. So it was our vision to expand the horizons of the store, to make it as much of a one-stop shopping opportunity mm-hmm. as we could within the confines of its four walls. You know, the store was immediately successful. You know, we worked very, very hard to help it be so, but we were supported very strongly from the get-go. People were, you know, happy to see the vision of the store expand and see mm-hmm. products that they hadn't seen in the store before. Mm-hmm. And shortly thereafter, well, it was a year and a half, 2 years later, we moved down to the McKinley Center,
which is where the store...
Well, it was originally a supermarket way back when. Uh-huh. It had been Tuttle's Drugstore. A number of years, uh-huh. right? And had been closed down for a year
that's
and a half
right.
before
okay.
we went
Tuttle's.
In. So then it got a nice facelift, and we went into 5,000 square feet there. That mm-hmm. was our big leap, you know, doubling our square footage. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple other businesses that went in next door to us. And that, the development of the McKinley Center basically shifted the epicenter of town in many ways over to where it became a little bit more of the central mm-hmm. hub of town. The plaza, mm-hmm. the town plaza got built shortly thereafter, mm-hmm. and the distillery got turned into the movie theater complex mm-hmm. About a year later. So that effectively moved the epicenter of town, and you know, the store was, you know, it was very, very successful from the get-go.
So we're talking 93.
Yeah, that was...
To really 96.
Yeah, 93.
95 or 96 when you did the expansion.
Yeah, we opened that store to 5,000 square feet. Mm-hmm. A year later, we had the opportunity to open our store in Santa Rosa. And then,
is that on Wailupa?
Yeah, on Wailupa. Okay. And that had been a supermarket for 35 mm-hmm. years. You know, it's an old A&B market. And then we took over that store. And in its time, when we opened it, it was the largest natural food market in Northern California. It was viewed by some as an incredible risk on our part to go into a 22,000 square foot shop in a relatively unproven marketplace. But we really felt that that store was ideally located to serve the whole east side of Santa Rosa. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fortunately, we were proven right in our hopes and wishes. Mm-hmm. They did come true. And, you know, the store started out looking rather sparse as we just did our best to get it filled up. We had very little money to work with. My brother and I were basically dirt poor when we bought mm-hmm. our first store. And everything that we did... you know, we were bootstrappers all the way, and, you know, did our best with, you know, a supportive exchange bank, actually, mm-hmm. Kind of came to our rescue and assisted us and worked with us through the development of our business through the entire decade of the 90s. So we opened the Santa Rosa store, and then a year later went back and expanded the Sebastopol store to 10,000 square feet, doubled its size.
Doubled its size.
Yes. Didn't close. Weren't closed for a day. It was 5,000 square feet one day, and it was 10,000 square feet the next morning. And that was a very long night, I can tell you that. And then we you know, dusted drywall powder for 2 months afterwards. Construction and retail just don't mix, you know. But when you gotta have to keep the doors open, you do whatever you need to do to keep serving your clientele and buying and selling your products.
Yeah.
And then a year later, well, 2 years later, actually, after that expansion, we had the opportunity to move into what was then Carl's Market, in Petaluma.
That's right.
Yeah.
Carl's Mark. I remember, Carl's very
yeah,
well.
That had been a grocery store for many, many years. And, you know, those old style independent stores were just not, they were not cutting it at the time. You know, mm-hmm. they'd just really been overtaken by the larger conventional chains who, you know, obviously have all the money and tremendous amount of talent. And you know, the traditional independent grocers who were not looking forward, who were not being more progressive with their vision of where mm-hmm. food was moving, were just getting squeezed out of the market. They just become kind of large convenience stores.
Yeah.
And so the opportunity for us to go into that store was, you know, a blessing for us, and uh-huh. and they were happy to move on too. So we opened that store, and you know, it was successful from the get-go.
And so you went, when you were at the little place in 91, how many employees did you have?
Six.
And at the height of the empire of Food for Thought, how many employees had you
acquired? We had just under 400.
Wow. So in just 6 years, you went from six employees to 400.
Yeah.
That must have made your head spin.
My head was spinning in a major way for 10 years.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was a tremendous learning curve for me to, you know, not only learn how to, you know, better my skills as a retailer, but how to grow a company.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're very, very different skills.
Yeah.
You know, having a produce knife in my hand and knowing how to display and take care of, you know, fresh produce is one thing, but learning how to manage a growing company and all that entails, mm-hmm. all the legalities, all the infrastructure, all the bodybuilding and framework that you need mm-hmm. to develop to be able to handle all that muscle. It was a tremendous learning curve for me,
mm-hmm.
and you know, fortunately I stayed studious, and we didn't grow ourselves out of business.
No, and then what happened in 2001? Or 2000, maybe.
What happened in 2000?
Yeah, I mean, you became Whole Foods. But I'm curious, did Whole Foods approach you because they wanted to expand into this area? Or you were saying, okay, we need to stop now?
No, I was very happy doing what I was doing.
Oh, okay.
You know, through a number of personal contacts, people mm-hmm. that I had known through the years at Whole Foods, you know, they made contact with us. They'd expressed interest in coming up to the county, you know, in their way, you know, with us or without us, and more wanted to do it with us mm-hmm. rather
so they
than
would have, if
around
you,
us.
They would have opened up and become your competitors.
Oh, potentially.
I mean, that was another
option. You know, that's one side of the equation uh-huh. that you know, I had to look at the uh-huh. time is what was going to happen moving mm-hmm. forward. So, you know, they called me through the years and said, how's it going up there? We're interested. And, you know, my usual response was, you know, we're getting by. we're doing okay. But, you know, back of my mind, it was always, you know, please just stay as far away as you possibly
sure.
can so that we can, you know, grow in peace and
yeah.
and do our best to do our best and
sure.
and watch our little enterprise grow. You know, I got a call in the latter part of 2000, kind of the same conversation, and something in me was curious about what furthering that conversation would really mean.
Mm-hmm.
And what it would mean for me and my family and for our business as well. So I had the conversation. And, you know, as a result of that, you know, we moved forward in the selling of our business to Whole Foods.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were other options for us as far as selling the business.
So there were other...
And we had a couple other suitors, yes, uh-huh. which is always nice to have
when
you're trying to sell anything.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was a blessing for us. But we felt that Whole Foods would really carry on very well
uh-huh.
The integrity of the business that we had felt that we had developed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we respect them highly as mm-hmm. operators. You know, they're tremendous operators. And certainly they face their challenges of their grand scale and you know, the talent that they have in their company is extensive, and I have a lot of personal friends who work in mm-hmm. their company, and I respect them greatly. Mm-hmm. So we were happy that they were interested in, and you know, happy to have them as the operation that would carry the business forward.
Mm-hmm. And that sale took place in February of 2001?
Yeah, February 2001.
And somewhere, mm-hmm. either before, during, or after, you also had this other life, and we're going to hear a little bit about that, a little bit of that right now.
Isn't spring your favorite season? Watching the flowers blooming up out of the ground, seeing the snow melt down. Boy, you may dig winter time, but spring is my joy. It's got me feeling so glad. The days are breezy. You got the time to say hello and give a smile. Feeling her good is in style. You may dig winter time, but spring is my joy. It's something special, haven't you observed? It makes you glad to be alive. It's not absurd to say spring helps you survive the winter's long, miserable snow and rain. Gives you hope to know that spring will get a refrain. You only have to believe the day is coming. The world is humming, thinking about how good it'll be, and it goes double for me. You may dig winter time, but spring is my joy.
If you have a good ear, you recognize that as our guest, Ernie Shelton, natural foods grocer and jazz singer. Is this a long-time pursuit, or is this something new?
Oh, it's a long-time pursuit. Uh-huh. I mean, I started singing and dancing when I was 5 years old. I lived in Willits. I lived up in the boonies, and there was a woman who moved to town from, well, she had been in the Bay Area for 3 or 4 years, a tap dance teacher. Actually, she was certified tap and jazz and ballet teacher. She was originally from New York City. She'd grown up in New York, studied dance. She taught in the Bay Area, and she ended up in Willits.
Willits.
It's a very long story, which I won't go into how she got there, but she opened a dance studio in Willits and had a little studio in Laytonville as well. And she was there for 5 years, and I started dancing when I was 5 years old.
Tap?
Yeah, tap dancing. Yeah. And then I started taking voice lessons from another great teacher who was in Ukiah, a woman by the name of Connie Cox. And they were both wonderful teachers. It was just an amazing thing that they were both up there.
What a great thing. And
yeah, small
so
town
you
Ville.
Continued with that.
Yeah, that was really going to be my profession of choice. Uh-huh. I was going to be a song and dance man. That's what I wanted to be. And I've got a great little story to tell. It's my great-grandmother came to America from Sicily. When she was 14, or actually she was a little bit younger than that. She had a brother who was 14. She was 11 or 12. And the two of them came to America by themselves and ended up in Colorado with an uncle. Anyway, she ended up living in San Jose, and I used to visit her all the time. And she was a great woman. And I remember one day, you know, sitting in her little, in her kitchen built-in booth, you know, uh-huh. the old built-in style kitchen yeah. tables in this little tiny stucco house that she had, and her saying to me, "Ernie, what do you want to do when you grow up? You know, what do you want to do when you grow up?" I said, "Grandma, well, I want to be a song and dance man. You know, I want to sing and tap dance." And she got this kind of woeful look in her eye, and she said, "Ernie, learn to do something with your hands. Learn to do something with your hands." She turned away, and it was only many years later that I was that I learned that her husband, who was not talked about too much in the family, because he sort of came and went, and, you know, he'd come around every year and they'd make a baby and then he'd be off and away, you know, disappearing. And she had 8 kids that she raised by herself. Well, come to find out that one of his ways of making his way in the world was he was a traveling one-man band.
Oh, wow.
So I have some newspaper articles that my mom had saved of him. So that was the woeful look in my great-grandmother's eyes.
Oh, how
Ernie, learn to do something with your hands.
So it's in the blood.
So anyway, I studied song and dance for all of my childhood up and, mm-hmm. you know, till I, you know, was young college years. Mm-hmm. And then my life took an abrupt change and I ended up not mm-hmm. going that path.
Mm-hmm. But you do perform now sometimes.
Yeah. No, I've came back to it. I've always sung recreationally uh-huh. through my adult life and have really been studying jazz music pretty seriously for the last 8-10 years.
Mm-hmm. And a few years ago you put together a big band?
Yeah, in 2005 I put together a big band, a 12-piece band that was modeled after the Marty Page Dectet and a music that he did with primarily with Mel Torme. Marty Page was a jazz arranger in the early 50s, a West Coast jazz arranger, pianist, played in small groups, trios, quartets. He was basically handpicked by Mel Torme to help put together a group that was kind of modeled after some of the larger octets, nonets, Miles Davis, Birth of the Cool Band. Dave Brubeck had an octet. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of them happening at that particular time on the West Coast. And so Torme handpicked Marty Page to write these arrangements for him at a juncture in Torme's career when he was moving away from following Frank Sinatra footsteps mm-hmm. and really wanted to be a more in the jazz singer mold. Mm-hmm. So they put together the Marty Page Dectet and, recorded 5 or 6 fantastic albums through the course of the 50s. And the arrangements are just fantastic because Page wrote in a way that was a real breakaway from the traditional big band, mm-hmm. Swing big band of the 40s. He wrote in a very ensemble-oriented manner and gave each voice in the band a very important place, mm-hmm. Almost a solo voice, you know, in the ensemble.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
And did things with harmony and ways of writing that were a real breakaway from the type of sectional writing of big band music.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we go back to talk about grocery, and we are going to come up to the present and Sheldon's and some of the products you have. Why don't we hear one more of this side of you?
Okay.
I look at you and suddenly something in your eyes I see. Soon begins bewitching me. It's that old devil moon that you stole from the skies. It's that old devil moon in your eyes. You and your glance make this romance too hard to handle. Stars in the night, blazing their light, can't hold a candle to your razzle-dazzle. You've got me flying high and wide on a magic carpet ride full of butterflies inside. I wanna cry, wanna croon, wanna laugh like a loon. It's that old...
It's Mouthful. It's Michelle Jordan. It is KRCB. Thanks for tuning in. Hope you've had a nice day. We're talking with Ernie Sheldon, currently of Sheldon's Market, and that was Ernie singing. I have like 100 questions I would like to ask you, like all
away.
At once. one of the things I'm always curious about, and I think it's good for people to know, is, and without spending too much time on it, because I know it's a huge topic, what is the process of filling the shelves of of a full service grocery store. How do you get product onto the shelf? And along with that, because I know that there are several different ways. I know that people come to see you to sell. I know that there are shows like the, you know, all the various food mm-hmm. shows, specialty mm-hmm. gourmet food shows, that kinds of thing.
Yeah.
But I also know we're in an agricultural reason. We're in a region.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a tradition, certainly there was an old tradition of, you know, showing up at the back door, do you want to buy these mushrooms, that was really, really began to be revived with Chez Panisse and the word that Chez Panisse was buying. So how does all that factor into the life of a grocery store like Sheldon's and the previous ones you've had?
Well, it's different for every store.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, let's talk about yours.
So we'll talk about mine because other people have different philosophies. And so you know, you can either make your life more complex or simple, you know, in business and, you know, how you treat procurement, you know, plays into that. So it's sort of all of the above.
Okay.
And it depends on what kind of products you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have, even in our little store, you know, we've got probably, oh, 100 different vendors that we work with.
Mm-hmm.
The natural food industry historically has been a home for entry level for new startup food businesses.
Okay, so let's
that's not quite so much the case anymore.
Okay.
As the industry has grown and kind of matured.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we certainly see ourselves as still an opportunity for that, but, you know, uh-huh. we're just a small little fish. So the procurement happens in all sorts of different ways. You know, historically, we love to have people come to our back door and sell us product, and we still do.
So that's still an opportunity that's
yes,
available?
Yes, it's certainly still an opportunity for someone, you know, in our particular uh-huh. position, and it was something that we nurtured during our life at Food for Thought
mm-hmm.
and, you know, helped develop and support some of the local farms that we had
mm-hmm.
And became a central outlet for a number of them. Mm-hmm. You know, you can only support so many people as mm-hmm. a single store or even
sure.
having three or four stores,
uh-huh.
you know, and you do your best to, you know, support everybody that you can at a meaningful level for them.
Mm-hmm.
And for you. So it depends on whether that person is selling fresh produce or if it's a grocery supplier or a dairy supplier
mm-hmm.
or so a fishmonger or, you know, somebody selling you products for ingredients that you want to be able to offer the public,
mm-hmm.
whether they're specialty gourmet products. You know, many of those you buy direct from a manufacturer or a producer.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them you buy from a distributor.
Uh-huh.
So it cuts all sorts of uh-huh. all sorts of different directions.
So it is possible still to have very local. I'm thinking primarily of produce.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people who grow around Hillsborough can still come to you and say,
yeah.
"Well, I can give you, you know, 10 flats of, you know, raspberries every week in the
yes.
growing season," something like
yes.
that.
Yes, and this year we'll be a little bit more ahead of that game than
mm-hmm.
we were last year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we took over the store last July, and
sure.
we're already in the middle of our primary growing season
yeah,
here,
sure.
of course. And, you know, didn't inherit a lot of that
mm-hmm.
in that store.
Mm-hmm.
So this year we're starting to develop it more. You know, we're
mm-hmm.
getting, you know, product from, you know, half a dozen local guys up there now
mm-hmm.
that we've started with. And, you know, you mentioned Sebastopol Berry Farm. I called her last week. And, you know, Dry Creek Peach. And, you know, they hadn't been in the store historically.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I've put on my, you know, sensing device and,
mm-hmm.
you know, getting out and about and talking to some of the local mm-hmm. growers that I either worked with in the past or who have
mm-hmm.
just come on the scene
mm-hmm.
in the last, you know, over the last few years mm-hmm. to see that we can become a reflection and representatives for those growers and for our local marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were out of the business for almost a decade.
Yes.
Did you
8 years.
Yeah. Did you, when you started up again, Did you see a change in the customer? Or is that even fair since you had not been in Healdsburg before?
Well, I hadn't been in Healdsburg, and it's a little different community. Yeah. I mean, it's Healdsburg and Sebastopol are two very different places.
Very different.
And you know, different than Santa Rosa or Petaluma as well. I mean, it's one of the things that I've loved and appreciated about our county is its diverse ecosystems, and those are the people systems as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know that the customer has... You know, the customer has probably matured in many different ways with their exposure to higher quality of foods.
Mm-hmm. So there is that demand
over, for... No, certainly. Uh-huh. And I mean, and Healdsburg is a world-class food center, mm-hmm. you know, and we have a very sophisticated audience. Mm-hmm. There are people there who have, you know, traveled the world and, you know, lived in very, very sophisticated places and have chose to... live in Healdsburg mm-hmm. as a primary home or secondary home or retirement mm-hmm. place. And so it's unique unto itself. You know, I've seen certainly changes in the industry, certainly mm-hmm. changes in the supply line, certainly lots of consolidation, lots of ownership change that we started to see as we were, you know, leaving the business in mm-hmm. 2000. You know, it's been an interesting evolution, not unlike, you know, kind of the maturity that happens with many, mm-hmm. many industries as they're mm-hmm. youthful and entrepreneurial mm-hmm. and everybody can find a place at the table. And then, you know, as things mature, mm-hmm. that becomes a little bit more difficult. Yeah. So it's kind of fun for us and for me to be downsized again and uh-huh. be small enough to, you know, appreciate and be receptive to all the... a higher level of localization.
How has the change in the word organic, has that had any impact on your business?
Well, I don't know if the word has changed all that much. I mean, it's certainly...
I mean, just the ownership of the...
Well, you know, it was coming into a clearer definition uh-huh. with the federal standards, you know, in early 2000s. And... you know, I appreciate that. It was mm-hmm. our dream in the early 70s when I was involved in, you know, the founding charter members of CCOF when I was mm-hmm. in Southern California and, you know, kind of the birth time of the industry, mm-hmm. of the natural foods industry. Yeah. And, you know, as part of the cultural movement of the time and mm-hmm. dreaming about, wow, will there come a day when we see all these organic foods in Safeway, you know? I mean, that was 30 years ago,
yeah.
and now, you know, here it is. And now we continue to see, uh-huh. you know, tremendous growth of organic foods in the conventional marketplace. And I think that that's a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. I think that anything that removes harmful chemicals from agricultural use and creates end products that are safer and healthier mm-hmm. for the consuming public mm-hmm. are a positive move.
Do you think the fat phobe is over?
Oh, it appears to be.
Okay, good. Good. And now I think I'm ready to talk about one of my favorite subjects.
Okay.
You sell a lot of salts.
Yeah.
I think you brought some information about them,
well,
too, didn't
I
you?
Well, I did. You know, I brought a little... some write-ups. We just fired up this program, and you're much more in the know about these salts than, you know, I am. I'm a little baby in my learning about these. But, you know, speaking of one of the natural food shows that I was, and exposure to product, we were at the Natural Foods Expo in Southern California, an annual event that happens on the West Coast in February of this year. And I saw this company from out of Washington State that had this beautiful display of salts from around the world, exotic salts. And I thought, oh, I want to build a salt bar, you know. Because one of the things about the community of Healdsburg that we've discovered is just a very, very serious interest in high-quality ingredients, mm-hmm. you know, primary ingredients, because people do a lot of their own cooking. And they want the best ingredients that they can find. Mm-hmm. And so that's become a stronger focus for me and for my younger brother is to create opportunities for that in the store. Mm-hmm. And so I saw these salts, this array of beautiful salts in, at the expo, and I said, we got to do this. You know, nobody's doing this, and so let's create Sonoma County's first salt bar. So, you know, people don't come and order at the counter, but
you don't get a shot of salt.
You don't get a shot of salt, but
you can.
But you can. Ask somebody for a taste. And
you must
and
have about 18.
There's 16, 18 different kinds, from all around the world. You know, from flake salts to all kinds of different, large and small crystal salts. Yeah.
The black salt's probably the most distinctive. In you taste it and you don't have to sit and contemplate what the difference is.
No.
And some of them, I mean, some of the more newly available salts are trendy. They're new. They're sort of capture this whole gourmet ruckus.
Uh-huh.
And I don't mean, I like the word ruckus.
Yeah.
But black salt actually has a really long tradition, harvested in primarily, I know it from Italy.
Uh-huh.
And my understanding of it is it's ancient rotting vegetation that was captured in the salt, these huge salt deposits that captured the decaying vegetation and created a sulfur flavor trapped within the salt crystals. And it's sort of, it can look black when it's in a rock form, and it's really purple when you grind it. And if you do something like put it onto lassi, especially just plain yogurt, you know, just unsweetened lassi. Don't put it on your mango lassi. You put it on lassi or even plain yogurt. Uh-huh. It adds a very traditional, absolutely traditional flavor that if you've traveled much in India, you'll definitely recognize it.
Used a lot in Indian cookery. Yeah.
So I think that's probably the most traditional. But then there's the Himalayan pink salts.
Mm-hmm.
There's that really, if you're stand facing the salt bar, on the right is that pale gray one. That one was so interesting. I can't remember what's in it, though.
Well,
it's pale gray and it's bigger flakes.
Well, there's another dark salt that's
there's the Hawaiian black lava salt.
Yeah, there's the Hawaiian black lava salt.
Which doesn't come from lava.
No, it doesn't come from lava. It's actually mixed with charcoal, which is, you know, it's... had some therapeutic value as well. Not sure which one is on the right, whether that's just one of if it's a Celtic gray salt.
No, it's not a Celtic gray. It's different. It almost looks like little pieces of shaved cement. It's that kind of gray.
Yeah.
It's very interesting, but I'm not remembering right now.
Yeah, off the top of my head, I'm not quite sure which one it is.
And then you also have smaller containers of salts that have been mixed with various... I think you have a ginger salt.
Well, those are the sugars.
That the ginger sugar?
Those are the flavored sugars.
But there's the flavored sugars, but then...
Oh, yeah, there are some other infused ones.
Some
other flavored ones that are in smaller jars.
Right.
That aren't the bulk dispensed ones, but they're also specialty ones.
Yeah, and I think one was ginger.
They're very, very cool. There could be a ginger. Yeah. There's a lime. There's a couple others in the specialty ones that are very, very cool.
How long has it been there, the salt bar?
Just about a month.
How's it selling? How are the salts selling?
Oh, they're selling well.
They are.
Oh yeah,
so
yeah.
So people are finding them.
Oh, the curious are you know, dipping a spoon and taking a little bit home and trying things out.
Sure.
You know, there's a couple smoked salts that are fabulous. You know,
they're really
seafoods or meats, any kind of.
They're an improvement. When I tasted the first smoked salt back in 1998. I think it was the first smoked salt in this country. And it was the sister of a chef over at the CIA in St. Helena, and he sent me some. And, you know, you couldn't take it on a plane with you because everyone would think there was a fire. I mean, it was intensely smoky, but as soon as you lifted that lid, that smoky flavor dissipated fairly quickly.
Yeah.
And if you left the flavor... wasn't locked in very tightly. It would definitely. I still have some, and there's no smoky flavor left.
Yeah, these ones are 48-hour cold smoked,
And they really have a depth.
Yeah, they're
and
it's there
a fair amount of complexity too.
Remains, yeah.
And they're good on fish, but you know what? They're really, really good on
what's that?
Deviled eggs.
Oh, yum.
Not just deviled eggs, but if you like hard cooked eggs, hot for breakfast with a little bit of really good butter, and then some smoked salt.
All right.
outstanding.
Thumbs up.
Yes. And now also the sugar, I thought, now I've never seen those. I've certainly seen lavender sugar.
Uh-huh.
See that in a lot of places in France.
Mm-hmm.
But you had some very unusual, you had an, it was a sweet onion
sweet
salt.
Sweet onions. No, it's a sweet onion sugar.
Okay. That's and right, because that I thought it needed some salt.
Yes, that's right. You said this needs a little bit of salt added to it.
It needs just a little salt.
But great for caramelizing, you know, roasted vegetables or, you know, a finishing sugar or something that you want to grill and get that
finishing.
Get that,
and most of this stuff,
caramelization.
And most of the stuff we are talking about is for finishing. You don't buy, when it comes to the salts, you don't buy this premium specialty, sexy, romantic salt and then put 2 tablespoons into your pasta water.
Right.
You know, you lose all those. Right. It's for the little salt sprinkle at the end and match it up. You know, don't be too geeky about it. Mm-hmm. Match it up with something nice, and it adds a really interesting quality.
Well, the sugars are made by a sister company to the salt company that I've been working with, also up in Washington, and they do all the flavor infusing with organic sugars as well.
Mm-hmm. The wild blueberry sugar, was really interesting.
Yummers, there's blueberry, raspberry, lemon, espresso. The ginger. I think we tasted the ginger.
Yeah, and
it's good.
Very good. And the wild blueberry immediately made me think of blueberry yogurt, raspberry yogurt, or kefir. Mm-hmm. And you sprinkle just a little bit of that on top.
Yep.
And not very much. You don't even need a quarter teaspoon. And first of all, it gives you that nice little crunchy texture, those little jewels between the teeth.
Yum.
Really nice. Really nice. So I'm glad to hear people are noticing.
No, they're going
I think you need a sign. I think you need this really cool sort of carved sign that says, you know, Shelton Salt Bar or something like that. You could get a block of the Himalayan salt.
Carve it and then backlight it.
It would look really great.
Good idea.
Okay, we don't have much time left.
Yeah.
Are there products in the pipeline over the next few months that you think are something people should be paying attention to, watching, anything we should know, questions we should ask, what's going on with fish? Can we eat it? What's the deal with mercury? How are you securing your fish? Or watch out for this fabulous new type of lettuce that we'll have in a week. I don't know.
Oh, well.
Anywhere we want to go.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the areas that we'll be expanding a little bit more, we just put in our seafood and poultry counter. You know, it's a little 6-foot counter, and we've got some great air chilled poultry from Mary's Poultry, and
it's fantastic. Know what that means, air chilled.
Air chilled is state of the art cooling process used in poultry production. After the chickens are killed, with any agricultural product, for it to last, you want to pull the heat out of it as quickly as you possibly can. Traditionally, and still used about 95% of the time in the States, that's an air chilled process. That's a water chilled process for chickens.
Okay.
So they go into an ice bath,
basically
with constantly flowing water.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't actually sit in the water, but the water's constantly moving so that there's no problem with bacteria. But it's a very, very water intensive process. Mm-hmm. And the chicken tends to take up a little bit of water as well in that process. State-of-the-art in Europe, used pretty extensively, and now coming to America is an air-chilled process where the birds are misted lightly with a water spray and then exposed to, you know, intensely cold air, you know, blown with cold air, not to the point of freezing.
Mm-hmm.
But just to pull the heat out of them as quickly as possible.
And where is Mary's located?
They're in the Central Valley.
Are they also pastured?
Yeah, they are. Uh-huh. They have a really good organic program that they've developed over the last 3.5-4 years. And they have a good natural program, too. It's mirror image to the organic program, but just without the organic grains. They've been their fourth generation poultry growers and have moved over into, you know, the natural organic growing over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. And mm-hmm. I've really got it, you know, have got it figured out. They've got mm-hmm. a wonderful program.
Interesting. That, well, I learned something I did not know
yeah.
about this air
yeah.
air chilled. Cool. Thank
yeah.
you.
You're welcome.
Seafood.
Seafood. You know, we've been working with a couple different local purveyors up mm-hmm. to this point, and you know, primarily with you know, local caught fish. I think that we'll be working with an operation called Clean Fish here in the near future that does some farmed fish around the world. That they sell fresh from very, very progressive, leading edge mm-hmm. Seafood farmers.
Yeah. And not all seafood farming is bad.
Nope.
Some seafood
nope.
farming is preferable. The mm-hmm. shrimp farming that is out there killing the mangroves and putting the mm-hmm. conventional fishermen, not a good thing. Open ocean, salmon,
there's
not a good thing.
There's a lot of... there's a lot of farming of seafoods. There's a lot of aquaculture that's not very healthy. And these guys are working and helping develop,
uh-huh. yeah.
you know, eight or ten different uh-huh. Growers around the country yeah. and around the world
yeah.
who are doing it really well
yeah.
and you know, setting the right example for others in the industry to
yeah.
follow.
So. Yeah, and then plus certain things, shellfish, you know,
yeah.
Yeah. Mussels, clams,
I mean,
oysters.
They actually
it's
have
better.
A great prawn program.
Uh-huh. Oh, they do?
Yeah.
That's good
They've
to know.
They've got a wonderful North Sea salmon program
uh-huh.
that's just phenomenal.
Uh-huh.
And
they're doing the, from
integrated.
The whole chain from what the
yep.
salmon is eating and
yeah.
that sort of thing. That'd be interesting.
Yep.
Really interesting to know more about. Does Shelton's have a website?
In the making.
In the making.
Yes.
Okay. In the meantime...
I can be contacted at
okay.
ernie@sheltonsmarket.com.
Okay, and that's Shelton
That'll
with a T.
Yes.
ernie@sheltonsmarket.com.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
our store's on Center Street.
Two blocks north
of the plaza.
What are your hours?
We're open from 8 in the morning till 8 in the evening, 7 days a week.
7 days a week. And I should
yeah.
say you put in a salad bar.
We put in a salad bar about 3 weeks ago.
Is it yeah. popular?
Yes, it's doing very well. You know, we've worked just really hard to get the store up to snuff, so I'm proud of where we're getting. So,
well, I don't know if we have time for 30 seconds more of your music, but thanks for bringing along the CDs,
Oh,
too.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You know, it's just that whole thing of, wow, you do that, too.
Yeah,
you can
yeah.
know somebody, you can know your neighborhood grocer for so long, and then you find out he's a painter, he's a song and dance man. You just never know. It's
yeah.
great. So thanks so much for taking time to come down.
My pleasure.
And thanks to you for taking time to listen to another tasty episode of Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. Have a great week. Now I have one tip for you. Traverso's is opening its doors quietly on Tuesday. So it's actually, I think we're only without Traverso's for 2.5 weeks or something. So Traverso's at their new location up on Stage Gulch in the Fountain Grove area. See you there Tuesday morning.
Whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. And little man, little Lola wants you. Make up your mind you have no regrets. Recline yourself, resign yourself, you're through. She always gets.
Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.